from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, with the passing on Friday of George Herbert Walker Bush, we'll talk about the life and legacy of the 41st President of the United States and how politics have changed since he occupied the White House. Also, last week's guilty plea by Michael Cohen, President Trump's personal attorney, continues to reverberate in Washington. We'll look at what might be next for the Mueller investigation, and we'll discuss the fallout from the weekend's G20 summit in Washington and a possible deal to replace NAFTA. It's all next, after this. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Wednesday, family and friends will gather at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. for a memorial service for former President George H.W. Bush, who died Friday at the age of 94. Here's President Bush during his 1991 State of the Union address.
We have within our reach the promise of a renewed America. We can find meaning and reward by serving some higher purpose than ourselves, a shining purpose, the illumination of 1,000 points of light.
We're going to talk in this hour about Bush One's legacy and other political news in the headlines, including last week's bombshell guilty plea by President Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen, who admitted that he lied to Congress about plans to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. We'll also get the latest on the Mueller investigation and discuss the G20 summit, where the U.S., Canada, and Mexico signed a new trade deal to replace NAFTA. Joining us, David McEwen, who's here in studio with us, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Also good to have Shannon Pettypiece, who joins us from Washington, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Welcome, Shannon Pettypiece.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both. And David, let me begin with you, and let's talk about President Bush. We're talking about Bush 41, of course. A lot of people in mourning, and certainly a great assessment of what he had to do with his presidency and what he accomplished. And there was a great deal that was accomplished, and I want to talk about that. But let's first talk about the man, because there's a good deal of a sense of he's being extolled for his public service, for being, you know, a man of real humanity. And a lot of the things that are being said about him are certainly panegyrics. He was a statesman. He was a man. Was a family man, had great kindness. Many people saw him as a man of faith and so forth. But you can't help but make the contrast when you hear a speech like the 1,000 Points of Light to the president who is now in the White House, who came into office talking about carnage and, you know, doesn't seem to have the same kind of willingness to emphasize public service. I mean, these are big contrasts.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at really the legacy of 41 and what happened, that really was a pivot point in our politics. You had the destruction or demise of the Soviet Union. You had the rise of democracies in Central and Eastern Europe. But this is a guy who not only was a president at that time, but also had the Willie Horton ad of 1988 in that campaign, that divisiveness. And while we'll extol the virtues of this president, it also was a moment in our politics that began to change and a coarsening of our politics and a coarsening of us. Hyperpartisanship, the rise of Newt Gingrich shortly thereafter, obviously the Clinton years and the impeachment near the end of his second term. But really, Bush 41 represents that pivot moment in our politics where things really kind of change dramatically. Domestic politics matter in a huge way. And if you look at immigration today or what's happening today with this president and what's happening, obviously, last week and the few events that have occurred recently, we really are in a different place where partisanship matters over party, over any other sense. And in that ongoing kind of component, we've lost decorum and decency. And that's what you see today.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Willie Horton and Shannon Pettypiece. That's been one of the things that has certainly overshadowed a lot of the legacy, as it's so described, of former President Bush. That was an idea of Lee Atwaters, of course, who was serving the president at the time. This was an African-American who had a convicted record as a convict, and that was brought out as if, you know, he was a threat in a major way. And there was also, however, some really extraordinary statesmanship as we just heard from David McEwen. I mean, unifying of Germany and really breaking down a lot of the barriers that existed, the Persian Gulf War, which he's given a lot of credit for, and in terms of world affairs. How does that balance in your mind in terms of, well, pluses and minuses or both sides of the ledger? Because after all, he was also ambassador to China and did a lot to firm up relations with China at the time, which are now with trade deals getting under a different kind of scrutiny. But at the same time, a lot of people criticize him because he didn't do enough on Tiananmen Square.
Right. Well, and of course, there's, you know, no perfect president. But I think when you bring up his foreign policy legacy, it's, you know, maybe especially on the Cold War, I think one that had, you know, not really been viewed. A lot of people give Reagan credit for ending the Cold War. But of course, you know, it was, you know, Bush was also involved in that. You know, I mean, one of the things, I guess you can weigh accomplishments.
And excuse me, we should never forget the fact that he was the head of the CIA when there was a lot of nefarious things being done. I'm sorry.
Right. I mean, I would say one of the things I've been hearing people talk about and the people I've talked to, of course, there's the accomplishments, but there's also the temperament that he had, which is, of course, is in a lot of people's minds these days with this president who has a very unorthodox presidential temperament. But when people talk about, you know, President Bush, they talk about how modest he was, how he didn't brag about himself. You know, he was humble in a lot of ways, the way he would tune out a lot of distractions in the media. Yes, he knew that the media was never, you know, going to be fair to him, and they would say things that he didn't like or he disagreed with. But he, you know, continued, you know, his presidency and to do things the way he would want to. And I saw someone shared a letter that he left for President Bill Clinton, it just taking such a different tone than the one we see today. And so I think as much as his legacy of foreign policy and accomplishments or shortcomings that he had, I think his personality is on a lot of people's minds today.
You mentioned
as well.
The letter he left for President Clinton. I wanted to just read a paragraph of it appeared in The Washington Post. Of some eulogy that President Clinton offered on behalf of George H.W. Bush, who he did a great deal of relief work with in Katrina and in Africa. And he says, former President Clinton, given what politics looks like today, it's easy to sigh and say George H.W. Bush belonged to an era that is gone and never coming back, where our opponents are not our enemies, where we are open to different ideas and changing our minds, where facts matter, and where our devotion to our children's future leads to honest compromise and shared progress. I know what he would say. Nonsense. It's your duty to get that America back. Makes sense, doesn't it, David McEwen?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, look, in some ways, our politics and people tuning out from politics, it's really a dark winter in some ways. And Bush, and you hearken back to 41 and what President Clinton is talking there, or what President Obama has talked about, or even 43, Bush's son, you're looking back with a duty, and that public service duty is certainly reflected by Bush the Elder's public career, the devotion he had to the country, and that's something that's sorely lacking at this point. And that public service component, the duty to be above oneself, is something that perhaps we can capture in this moment, at least until the government runs out of money on Friday.
He was 17 years old, Shannon Pabies, and he joined the Navy and became a Navy pilot and was a hero. And I can't help thinking about the fact that he was shot down, and if he had been a prisoner of war, perhaps our president would have called him a loser, because that's what he said about John McCain.
Well, and I heard people talk about how he never really bragged about his military service, or he never really even talked about it. He never, you know, wanted to bring up this idea that he was some war hero. One of the
but he was
right, exactly. But he wasn't going to be the one to bring that up and go on and on about it. I mean, other people could, but it wasn't his style. One of the things I hear people debate about a lot when you raise this issue of whether this era of politics is gone, or I'm sorry, the piece that you raised, whether this era of, you know, President Bush style politics is gone. I hear a lot of people debating that in Washington right now. Can we go back, you know, in 2020 or 2024? Will we have another orthodox president who, right, had this career of public service, who came up through the military or, you know, through government, through Congress, was a governor? Or are we past that era of the sort of traditional orthodox president that we have gotten used to? And is the public tired of that? Does the public feel like that failed them and they are willing to take risks on, you know, a president who doesn't have that sort of conventional public service experience because they feel like that hasn't worked out for the country in the way they wanted to?
It's a big question, and it's what we're going to have to wait on. But let me, as long as we're talking about the difference in presidents, we now have a president who has an ongoing investigation, and also like to get let me bring Ken White into this. And Ken, please join us in this discussion. Ken's an attorney at Brown, White & Osborne, LLP in Los Angeles, former federal prosecutor and co-host of All the President's Lawyers on KCRW. Good to have you aboard, Ken. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Talk about the plea last week, Ken. What did we hear from Michael Cohen? I mean, essentially, he said he lied to Congress.
He did. He said that he lied repeatedly, both in a letter and in live testimony. And he said that he lied in order to conform to individual number one, that being obviously the president, and individual number one's public strategy. So Michael Cohen did not go as far as to claim that he was instructed by the president to lie, but he made it very clear that he lied in order to support the president's narrative, namely that negotiations with Russia over a Trump hotel in Moscow had ceased very early in 2016, rather than well into campaign season.
So the timing is certainly different from what he first presented to Congress. And this is looking like, I think some wags said this is like a tale of two Trump towers. But also, we have to add a penthouse in there. Let me go back to you, Shannon Pettypiece, on this. I mean, let's sketch this out for our listeners, what we're talking about here and what's at stake.
Well, with the penthouse, I mean, there's at this point, I think, a lot of sort of implications going around, but nothing, you know, necessarily definitive. But I always try and remind people with this Mueller investigation, we only have a few pieces of the puzzle, and we don't even know how big the puzzle is. We don't even know how many pieces there are, but we keep getting these pieces. And last week was another example where we got another piece or two in this. We got this idea that this Trump Tower project had been going well into the campaign, that Michael Cohen felt a need not to be honest about the timeline, and that Felix Sater, this developer that the Trump Organization had been working with on the Moscow project, had proposed giving the $50 million top floor penthouse of this possible development to Vladimir Putin as a way to increase sales. And the idea that a bunch of other oligarchs would want to live in a building if Putin had the penthouse. And that might sound like a great real estate marketing idea, but it could also be seen as a bribe or some sort of quid pro quo. But we don't know if there was any quid pro quo, and we don't really know if this was something that even the then sort of candidate Trump was aware of, or if this was something that Felix Sater, this developer, you know, just had cooked up in his head and, you know, was kicking around with Michael Cohen.
Yeah, there's so many characters and moving parts here. It's hard and really challenging to keep it all in place here. But Ken White, if I go back to you here, just talk about, if you would, for a moment. Well, actually, let me go back to you on this, Shannon, because we only have a couple minutes with you. So let me just get your take on this. When we're talking about the offer of a penthouse and all the rest of this deal that was lied about by Cohen initially when he went in front of Congress, and we have to get the emails through WikiLeaks and all that, but the president says nothing illegal here. It was just a business deal. You know, even if he was covering everything up, that's his argument. That's his defense.
Right. I mean, nothing illegal so far, but I think the issue is that we haven't seen all the pieces of the puzzle yet. And maybe when you see all the pieces of the puzzle, you can start connecting things together, that you get intent and motive, and you see what happened after June, or, you know, what other people have said. Right now, we just have Michael Cohen's version of the story. And a caution on these, Mueller, when Mueller puts out these public indictments, I always find the most interesting thing is trying to figure out what is not said in there versus what is said, because we do know that he keeps a lot of cards close to his vest. And when you read these, you know, court filings, you can see there are big holes in them and things that intentionally aren't being put out there because he is trying to keep, you know, some of his investigation under wraps so it doesn't tip off other parties and only put out the information that he feels is necessary to put out publicly to, you know, help support his case in court. So I guess just a lot we don't know. But right, of course, there's no, I mean, there is a campaign finance crime the president has been implicated for in the Southern District of New York with Michael Cohen, but no allegations from law enforcement about any sort of crime or from Mueller's team about any crime committed here.
Shannon, appreciate very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Shannon Pettypiece, who is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, and we're going to continue this discussion. I'm going to read a tweet that came from President Trump earlier today. Let's go to you on this, Ken White. Michael Cohen asks judge for no prison time. You mean he can do all of the terrible things unrelated to Trump, things having to do with fraud, big loans, taxis, etc., and not serve a long prison term? He makes up stories to get a great and already reduced deal for himself and get his wife and father-in-law, who has the money, off scot-free. He lied for this outcome and should, in my opinion, serve a full and complete sentence.
Yeah, I feel like I should send a bottle of Xanax to Trump's lawyers because this must be driving him absolutely crazy. It's really terrible to have someone who is so central to a criminal investigation running their mouth like this. It's generally disastrous. And if it weren't the president in the middle of a truly epically bizarre political situation, I think lawyers would be quitting over this type of behavior. Absolutely. Michael Cohen is asking for a non-custodial sentence. I don't think he'll get it, given the number of things he's pled to. But he is making some fairly dramatic revelations about Trump. And Trump is definitely feeling the heat. Cohen's plea last week really suggested that the president knew that he was lying to Congress. The reason is Trump has been following all this stuff obsessively and commenting on it. And it's very hard to believe that Trump didn't know what Cohen was saying to Congress, and that he knew it was a lie based on Cohen's testimony. So that's significant. I think the next shoe that may drop here is the one about who else lied about this Russian deal, who else lied about this overture to Russia to build a hotel. A lot of people were talking to investigators. A bunch of people were testifying to Congress. Did any of them lie? And if so, who?
That's a lot of focus now on Roger Stone, right?
Absolutely. And Trump also tweeted this morning praising Stone for omerta, basically, for refusing to testify against Trump, which I don't think actually helps Stone very much in his situation with the special counsel.
He also, the president also may have dangled a pardon for Manafort. That seems apparent, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, well, when asked, he said he hadn't ruled it out, I believe. But that's always been the subtext through this throughout. And with a Democratic House about to come in, I think he has to weigh the political and the chance that they will do hearings and investigations and that type of thing with what he wants to do, which is to, put the screws to the special counsel by pardoning people out from under his grasp.
Well, back to you, David McEwen. David McEwen is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State University. Where do the WikiLeaks fit in all this, and Julian Assange?
Well, obviously, with the changes with the Ecuadorian embassy and how they're treating Julian Assange, this could really blow the case open. And it also, you have to place this in context with what Robert Mueller does with the Paul Manafort and appearing directly to the court. By going and laying directly to the court where he thinks Paul Manafort has lied, he is going around anything that Ken Whitaker could do with him in terms of DOJ. And with Julian Assange being kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy, if that happens, things that the time frame moves up rapidly. Democrats taking over the House, as Ken White mentioned. You also have another component to this, and it brings...
Excuse me, you mentioned Whitaker. What is the likelihood of there are some constitutional questions about his being moved into the Attorney General office?
Right, and the president has decided that he likes Whitaker where he's at least right now. Now, this changes with everyone who's close to the president day by day, with tweet by tweet. But what that means is Democrats are going to be faced with pushing on this in the Senate. There's going to be a lot of horse trading on this, but right now Whitaker is in place. He'll stay in place at least in the short term. This all moves up. The Mueller timeline moves things much closer while Democrats are moving into the House. You also have to remember that Michael Cohen's lawyer is Lanny Davis. Lanny Davis, very close to the Clintons and what's happening there. With Democrats taking over and reading or releasing some of the secret testimonies that have happened, this happens in the spring. This pushes things up as well. So all of this is happening at once with all this cast of characters. And I think that we are near the end, perhaps not right at the end, but near in the latter phase of what's happening in the Mueller investigation at this point.
And what do we know, Ken White, about the whole WikiLeaks thing and essentially hacking the Democratic Party's emails and going to Podesta's emails and so forth? I mean, at this point, where is that moving along a trajectory in terms of possible prosecutions?
We don't know. We know because of an embarrassing error within the Department of Justice that it's very likely that Julian Assange has been charged with a federal crime. But we don't know what it is, whether it's something before that period when certainly the Obama administration was looking at him as someone they might like to charge, or whether it had to do with the 2016 election. But it seems that we are moving towards the point we find out, to the extent that the Ecuadorians kick him out, he loses his ability to hide, then sooner or later there's going to be an effort to extradite him here for the currently under seal criminal charges that apparently exist.
And Ken, where is the case against the president moving at this point, particularly in the recognition that maybe there's nothing at least criminal at this point?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, he's been saying all along as a mantra, no collusion, no collusion. I mean, do we have even evidence of piecing things together here that presents a narrative that's different than or puts a spotlight on collusion or cooperation or whatever we want to call it?
I don't think that the special counsel has revealed any evidence of collusion that would be criminal. That is participation by the president in illegal acts like hacking. But what you have to remember is that this phenomenon we've been seeing, where people are felled not by their initial criminal acts, but by their reaction to the investigation, is the rule, not the exception, in federal criminal investigations. So I would expect to see, whether or not there is any criminal collusion, I would expect to see more charges that really relate to the way people reacted to the special counsel investigation. And that could include accusations of obstruction of justice against the president, or even of lying in those questions that he apparently gave, that he responded to the special counsel.
But David McKeown, we really don't know what kind of cards Bob Mueller is holding here, do we?
No. I mean, we really are seeing only the tip of the iceberg. And what Ken is talking about, right, is the cover-up over what potentially is discussed. That becomes more the focus of what's happening here. And Bob Mueller has held those cards close to the vest. But if Democrats are able to release previously secret testimony, that changes the political dynamic here. It changes the focus for what the media does. It places pressure on Bob Mueller. So Bob Mueller doesn't want that all to spin out of control because he's remained silent. He's been the guy who really has controlled things. And if he's got 15 to 20 different strings of this investigation, he's got to tie all of that up. I think the Manafort testimony that will be relayed before the court opens up some of that Pandora's box. That's something that Bob Mueller and his team have to consider.
Well, there have been no leaks, really, except recently coming out on the Cohen thing and coming out smoking. And I'm wondering, in fact, from you, Ken White, where you see this headed ultimately, because the reality is that at this point, we keep coming up with something different almost every week.
Well, you're right, there haven't been leaks, and that's a good thing. Traditionally, the Department of Justice has used leaks as a way to attack targets and defendants and things like that. And it's admirable that Mueller has so successfully prevented them from his office. It was quite a surprise to see Cohen strolling into court to plead guilty to lying to Congress and not have that be the top of the news the day before, only finding out when it happened. But federal prosecutors build their cases slowly and steadily. That's their advantage. And I think you're going to continue to see steadily building week by week, month by month, more charges related to lying during the investigation until we find out whether or not there is any there, whether the heart of the investigation has any substance.
And the investigation is supposed to be, at least under the mandate, Russian involvement, and this gets us into other territories as it has done beyond that. Join us toll free, 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. We welcome them, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We began this hour talking about the life and legacy of George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States. And we've been talking about the Mueller investigation. And as promised, we will get to the G20 meetings in the course of this hour. But in the meantime, we'd like to hear from you and any thoughts you might have, particularly not only about President 41 Bush, but also about the ongoing Mueller investigation and the recent revelations that came out with Michael Cohen's plea. You can join us, and we welcome your thoughts. Toll-free, again, the number is 866-733-6786, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. David McEwen with us in studio, who is professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Sonoma State University. And Ken White with us by phone from L.A., attorney at Brown, White & Osborne LLP in Los Angeles, and former federal prosecutor, co-host of All the President's Lawyers on KCRW. And let's go to your calls. Let's go to first, Andrew, join us. You're on.
My question is about Felix Sater, who I'm wondering, does anybody have any insight into whether or not he's cooperating? Because it seems like he would be linchpin to the entire investigation and perhaps the whole history of the Trump crime enterprise. The Lawfare podcast this weekend actually speculated that he has been cooperating all along, and it seems like that would be pretty important.
Do we know whether Sater is cooperating? Any idea, David?
We don't know if he's cooperating, but we do know that Bob Mueller and his team have a series of intelligence.
We should mention who he is, first of all, actually.
Yeah. Right. He's
the guy who was talking about that penthouse.
Yeah, he's talking about the penthouse and been a deal maker that the president and his team and the businesses have been involved with a long time. You also have he had separate dealings with Ivanka and with Donald Trump Jr., who each had kind of their own independent means kind of going, separate from what Felix Sater was doing in terms of getting that Trump Tower. The president's been working on getting a tower or some type of Trump name in a big building in Moscow since at least 1987. But Sater has been someone who may be and has been speculated based on the intelligence analysis that Bob Mueller and his team has as someone who may have at least been singing to certain praises in what's happening. This is where we could circle back around where the WikiLeaks and what we have in WikiLeaks could be important as well here.
Well, there were, in fact, Ken White, there were a number of emails that Roger Stone had talking back and forth about building the Trump Tower in Moscow to Sater.
Yeah, and what we know about what they went after Michael Cohen for, what he pled to, what they're going after Jerome Corsi, the associate of Roger Stone, for, it's pretty clear that Sater is someone they'd be interested in. We don't know whether he's cooperating, but I think it's safe to say that they know about him and they are looking either to get him to talk or perhaps even to go after him. He would be a person they'd be very interested in.
Well, we're mentioning Don Trump Jr., and here's Dan with a question about Trump's son. Go ahead, Dan. You're on.
Yes, good morning. I have a comment and a question. Donald Trump Jr. has been in contact with the Russians, and that's probably a crime. So this Nothing Burger seems to be one of the more nutritious Nothing Burgers I've ever seen. and that's important because the Trump continually moves the goalposts. He denies everything and then just recently said, oh, yeah, I did it. Big deal. So that's the public relations issue. My question is a little more pointed. Let's assume that all of the financial crimes, the alleged money laundering going back decades, the tax fraud, the either direct culpability of Donald Trump conspiring with Russians or attempting to cover up his sons conspiring with Russians. Let's assume all that's true and that it comes out soon enough. What then? How do the Republican voters respond? How does the Republican Party respond? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, let's go to our political scientist here, David McEwen. You have a crystal ball.
All right, so there's a couple components to this. One is that last week Gallup releases a poll that says the number one threat that most Americans feel in the world is not North Korean nukes or the threat from Russia, but our division and polarization, our divided politics. Our richly divided politics, and that's the biggest threat. So as you move this, spin this forward, we take the caller's suggestion that the collusion, the financial crimes existing over decades have occurred. That means that Democrats are in a very difficult place. You move impeachment forward or at least begin doing that. There's a timing issue related to the 2020 elections, and then you got to move it to the Senate. It looks a lot like 1998 and former President Bill Clinton. It looks divisive for the country, and that sets forth a really difficult 2020 election period. And this is, I would argue, broadly what's going on here. The problems with the Mueller investigation for the Trump team are much more political than legal, I would argue.
Do you agree with that, Ken White?
Yes, I have to disagree with the caller. Trump or Trump Jr. or any of these people talking to the Russians is not inherently criminal. It's not even inherently criminal if he's asking them how they can help him win an election. It's only criminal if he's cooperating with them, conspiring with them to do criminal things like hack email accounts. And that's where so far we haven't seen evidence. It doesn't mean it's not there, but we haven't seen it yet. What we're seeing is more and more that people told stupid, easily provable lies about the contacts with the Russians. Now that's coming out, and that's having criminal consequences. And again, this is typical of the federal criminal justice system, where the cover-up becomes the issue.
Looking at some comments here from listeners that have to do with, actually, this is Richard who writes, your guests haven't talked about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Acts and how Trump does business.
Right. And we haven't seen all the evidence here in terms of what's going on. This is part of the Mueller task, is to hold on to that and to really not string out so many elements of the investigation that things get lost. This is complicated. It's difficult to prove collusion. But nonetheless, what happened with Michael Cohen and what's happened with Paul Manafort or any of the other, there's a total of 5 individuals now that have been convicted, with 33 individuals and 3 companies over the last year. All of that kind of stringing together a broad conspiracy, that's going to be difficult. And this is, again, why I think this situation is much more political than it is legal for troubles.
You know, I just can't help thinking about the comparison between President Trump and Bush Sr. I mean, in the sense that this president obviously has a very shaky, if not completely questionable relationship to the truth. And the idea, I think, behind a president like Bush was come forward, even though he worked for the CIA, he was a spook and all the rest of it, speak to the public in ways that are truthful about yourself.
Right. The president has to elevate our discourse, has to be aspirational, and we clearly are not in a place where that's going on.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. And Ken, you wanted to say something before we go to Kathy? Kathy, hold on a second.
Yeah, just to circle back to that person's question about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That's a law that makes it illegal for Americans to bribe foreign officials. And I think that's pretty clearly a reference to this news that the Trump Organization was considering offering a $50 million penthouse to the Russians, and whether that was in effect a bribe. It wasn't consummated, so it's questionable whether that's the sort of thing would ever be charged. But it is something that prosecutors would be interested in investigating.
I'm going to read a couple comments before I go to you, Kathy. Hold on a second. I just want to read what Bob says here. He says, Gore Vidal said back in the 80s that our political party system is actually one party with two branches, so it's possible to return to civility as exemplified by 41, so he says. And Ralph says, despite the flaws and bad policies, Bush certainly was a better man than his sons and far better than Trump will ever be. Why couldn't either President Bush find the courage to speak out against Trump? There's an interesting political question before we go to our next caller. David, you want to opine?
Right. So, right, what we have is a president who should elevate us, or at least elevate the country in their discourse, and
unify us,
right,
ideally.
Right. And that's what former presidents do, I think, to a certain degree. But you also have 41 at that pivot point. So, someone like Bill Clinton, Bush the Younger, or even Barack Obama, they're going to be placed in positions where they're going to be part of that coarsening of our politics, not the elevation. And that's where Bush, you know, he had poor health the last few years. So he had that moment. And clearly with Bill Clinton, they could have done something. And I think in a bipartisan way, that's where we need to be.
I wonder if he hadn't said, read my lips, if he would have been reelected for a second term. But let me go to you, Kathy. Hi, you're on.
Well, it sounds like your callers are your guests are making the same point, and you are too, Michael, that I was about to make, which is that while there were questions during his tenure about some of the actions that the first President Bush undertook, there was nobody who impugned his general sense of ethics and responsibility to the country. And to the degree that that has become the focus of our political process, I think that is the reason that we are so hung up on we haven't been able to make any progress on any of the major issues that face us as a country. And I think that, you know, we need to get back to focusing not on the character, not on the content of the character of the president, but on the actions that the president needs to take. And we can't do that as long as we have presidents whose personal character is the target of everything that everyone that comes along, right or left. So that's my comment.
Hi, thank you for that comment, Kathy. It's good to hear from you. And what about the legacy? Let's talk about this for a moment with you, David McEwen, of President Bush on AIDS. Stephen Thrasher in The Nation, let me quote what he says. He was saying, I was dismayed, not just that the hagiography afforded dead presidents would overshadow Bush's own appalling legacy on AIDS, but that his death would eclipse the tens of millions of lives we should be remembering today.
Yeah, I think when you look more closely at the record of all of our presidents, and certainly presidents that we try to elevate in the wake of their passing, we gloss over so many elements, specific elements of what happened. We could look, I talked about Willie Horton at the beginning, but we could look at AIDS and HIV. We could look at some of the policies that were continued in Latin America by that president. We could even look at some of the legacies of what happened in the Middle East in the aftermath of Gulf War I. All of these things, upon closer scrutiny, portray a much more complicated set of realities. And this is one of the beauties of having a forum audience. Just for an example, you understand those complicated realities when we look more closely at people who are fallible, especially in the office of the presidency.
Well, and here's another caller maybe questioning some of the hagiography of Bush 1. Rod, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for taking my call. I've heard it argued that as nice a guy and as many good things as Bush the Elder may have done, he missed the boat completely on Russia when the Soviet Union collapsed. Instead of coming up with a Marshall Plan that would have led to a true democracy in Russia, we ended up leaving them out in the cold and ended up with a kleptocracy run by Putin. In essence, we left Germany after World War I instead of Germany after World War II. I was hoping to get some comments on that.
There's an argument there, David McEwen.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if you look at the architects of kind of that post-91 national security policy, you look at Brent Scowcroft, for example, or General Colin Powell, you see a realpolitik, giving spheres of influence, pushing back in certain areas, but letting certain areas of the world kind of flounder or move, and having some type of realpolitik with the Russians in the wake of what was happening with the demise of the Soviet Union that really left the U.S. aback. And if you also look at that period, we see two things going on. One, the rise of constant conflict and the dramatic rise of terrorism, both things that were not anticipated or at least planned for in any deep way, unlike what we had done in the bipartisanship and of the bipolar world, which had existed for 45 years prior.
Just keep thinking about how these ledgers are so difficult, because you look on both sides. I mean, Bush, for example, with AIDS really had a record that is nothing to extol. But on the other hand, you know, he did a lot for disabled people. The Disabled Act came under his administration. I've got something else that's being brought up by a listener named Bob, who's joining us from Half Moon Bay, and that's Iran-Contra. Go ahead, Bob. You're on.
Yeah, I'm definitely, in retrospect, a liberal who's a fan of George Bush Sr., but my question is, what was his, you know, does anyone know more about what his involvement would have been in Iran-Contra? Because that certainly, he was present during that entire event, and, you know, I think that should be included in his legacy somehow.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, reflecting on that myself. What do you think, David?
Well, I mean, certainly Oliver North and what was being run by Admiral Poindexter, as my recollection, and how all of that was being handled. The vice president's office was in the loop in terms of what was going on. But afterwards, in terms of the cover-up or what was going on with Oliver North and with the shredding of documents, they were not involved with that. So in some sense, Vice President Bush at the time got a pass on all of that. And Ronald Reagan, that period of time, was seen as out of touch. And that was really the focus of what was happening. But in some ways, that pales in the comparison of where we are today. We've come a long ways, but in some ways, the song remains the same.
All right. I want to actually get to G20, but let me get a first Vikram on the air here with us. Vikram, go ahead. We're back to Mueller with you. Go on.
Thank you. Yes. I'll keep trying to keep it brief. Since it's not resolved, my understanding is that a sitting president can be federally charged or indicted. Can't Mueller basically coordinate with some of the states which seem to have some credible allegations or cases against Trump? Like, I think Cohen kind of implicated Trump in something, which could be potentially a state charge. A
lot of speculation about that, especially in New York State. Can I get you to weigh in on this, Ken White?
Sure. It's true that there's no settled constitutional case out there saying whether or not a sitting president can be charged. But the important point is that there is a Department of Justice memo saying that. And Robert Mueller is a rule follower, if nothing else, very much sort of the model of a classic G-man, and he's not going to go away from that Department of Justice role. So I don't think he's going to do anything that is the equivalent of trying to charge the president or participating in that. I think instead he's going to do everything he can, charge everyone he can up to that point, and then leave his report, which is going to be both a formal report that he submits to Department of Justice for possible submission to Congress, and it's going to be a report in the form of the series of prosecutions he's done, like this new charge against Michael Cohen, which is in many ways sort of expository, explaining what's been happening.
I want to read a couple of tweets, and then I do want to get to the G20. Marv says, hard to get all warm and fuzzy over the guy who gave us Clarence Thomas for the Supreme Court and NAFTA, and that's a good pivot point to talk about G20. But just another thought about the president from a listener who writes, I think as long as we have a reality TV celebrity-driven public, we'll have reality TV celebrity-driven politics. We need to get back to serious politics as we saw in the age of 41. So there are kind of two bracketed comments to think about and reflect upon. Let's reflect a bit about G20 and what actually transpired there. And David McEwen, I'm going to go to you on this. You mentioned NAFTA. There was some kind of a deal apparently worked out between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., a new NAFTA.
Right, a new NAFTA. And this new NAFTA is going to face a really uphill battle within Congress. It's going to take a long time to get this done in the midst of a presidency that with a president who seems to be focused a lot more on Bob Mueller and what's happening in that unraveling. And I think that
But also the Democrats are not necessarily going to get on board on this. There's a lot of labor questions.
A lot of labor questions. Look, with what happened recently with GM, we talk about Northeastern Ohio and what happened with Michigan, two key states that performed well for President Trump, just barely so, if you want to think of it that way. But if you think of this more broadly, this administration is treating trade differently than other issues. So if you're talking about dealing with China, for example, trade is different than hacking. If you're talking about Russia, different issues you want to portray with Russia as opposed to information operations, how the Russians see what they're doing on the computer or IT side. All of this, the administration treating these issues in a bifurcated way. But the president also has changed his manner, what he's doing. He clearly doesn't like these overseas tours. They bore him. He flew 10 hours each way to spend 2 days in Buenos Aires and seemed bored by the whole thing. This certainly occurs when he deals with our European allies, our allies throughout the world. But nonetheless, he's changed his approach for how he deals with the media in the midst of all of this. Now when he takes the walk from the White House to Marine One, he stops and talks to the press. He's also, he had a press conference that he canceled on Saturday. It's a much more offensive, but celebrity politics seat-of-the-pants presidency that's driven to reaching out to the media because he thinks that's his approach.
That reaching out to the enemy of the people?
That's right. But nonetheless, circle back to Ken. It also, if you're one of his lawyers, you're going to need a lot more than Xanax to deal with this because it's going to present some problems.
Well, what actually, let me just we'll go back to you in a moment, Ken, and our callers, but what actually came out of G20? I mean, you've got to talk about some kind of accord with China. There's maybe a hold for the moment in terms of was called the trade war, labeled the trade war. But at the same time, China and the United States are putting out completely different statements in terms of what was accomplished.
Right. And the Chinese are welcoming a trade war if that's what they want to have. The pass by or brush by of Putin and what was going to happen, where it's on again, off again, is a problem. And then obviously reaching out to go to Japan. So if the big announcement is that you had some type of NAFTA architecture that faces an uphill battle on Capitol Hill, that's kind of a nothing burger. And if you move forward you're going to go to Japan next year and perhaps the South Korea, those are some accomplishments that are helpful. The big news really is you put a pause on kind of the trade war battle and negotiations with China so that you can get something done. That may help car manufacturers. It won't help those workers in Northeast Ohio, at least anytime soon.
There were a couple of other things, though, Ken White, and I wonder if this has any. I think David's observation that the Mueller investigation was very much on the president's mind when he was in Buenos Aires, but there were a couple of other things that came about that were pretty significant and maybe related to the Mueller investigation. Well, not so much the president kind of turning his back to Mohammed bin Salman at the same time that he wants to do pragmatic politics with the leader of Saudi Arabia. But I'm thinking particularly of the fact that there was supposed to be a sit down again or a talk with Vladimir Putin that never took place. And the president may be trying to show that he shows some disfavor toward Ukraine and what happened with the Russians in the naval episode in Ukraine.
I don't know if there is a coherent reason or a coherent narrative behind what happened or not. I don't think, frankly, that any of us know. I do think that the Cohen plea, timed as it did, threw the president off his stride at the G20, and he did not get to do the sorts of press conferences and media manipulation that he's frankly quite good at. And to that extent, there might have been the impact of the Mueller investigation. But again, we're always guessing with this president, aren't we? Whether or not what he's doing is deliberate and part of a clever scheme or whether it's just part of who he is. And I don't have a strong sense of that after watching his behavior, including, you know, stalking off the stage at the G20.
Well, I mean, the president did, when he was on the gaggle from the White House to Marine One, he says that he's going to meet with Vladimir Putin. It takes half an hour to get to Andrews, and then 3 hours later, the White House announces that the Putin meeting is off after meeting with Mike Pompeo and others. So there clearly was some change of mind related to Ukraine and the message you're sending to the Russians.
Mike Pompeo and John Bolton are now his two major international advisors, and they were always very strongly anti-Russian, as far as Putin's leadership is concerned. I want to read something about NAFTA from Paul, who writes, NAFTA needed to be reviewed and upgraded. Trump turned it into a zero-sum game sort of negotiation. How many worst deals ever are there? And it did little more than alienate the Canadians and Mexicans, as well as the U.S. business community. No clear benefits. And let me read something. Let me go back to you, Ken White, about a comment from a listener named Carolyn about the Manafort charges. Carolyn writes, has there been any further validation of the Guardian story indicating that Manafort met with Assange several times in 2016? Also, I understand that Manafort faces state charges, which would still put him in jeopardy for prison time that a pardon couldn't address. Could you speak to those?
Sure. I have not seen anything validating the Guardian story, and I've seen a number of people expressing skepticism of it and that there would have been more evidence and different types of evidence like video or other surveillance if Manafort had visited. But I don't think it's been completely refuted either. I think it's out there in the ether. In terms of potential state charges against Manafort, it's clear there could be some. And in fact, the plea agreement he struck with Robert Mueller is pretty clearly calculated to put him in jeopardy of those in the event he's pardoned, because he admits to some conduct that could be criminal on a state level. And there's plenty of that already in the evidence that came out in his trial. So I don't think that those state prosecutors would likely bother if he doesn't get pardoned. But if he does get pardoned, then I think that Robert Mueller has set it up so that he is not out of danger yet.
And again, Ken White is former federal prosecutor and co-host of All the President's Lawyers on KCRW. And let's get another caller on here. We can continue with Mueller calls. Ty, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah. So historically, when any political tactics are used or tools or anything from one party or the other, it turns to be used against the other party after that. So if they don't deal a deadly blow to the Trump or Republican administration in this case, I wonder if we're going to see for the next two or plus years just another scenario like this, but against the Clintons or something else that'll be distracting the media for a long time.
Well, it's a certainly plausible scenario. Ken White, do you want to comment?
It is plausible, and I suppose that the special counsel investigation has turned it up a notch. But I think you have to look back at the Clinton special counsel investigation and see that it did happen then. And as I said, the types of things that are going on in this investigation, where people are hooked up not because of the underlying criminal thing they did, but because of how they react to the investigation, is the rule, not the exception. It's not new. So, you know, you see Scooter Libby was eventually convicted not for leaking Valerie Plame's name, but for allegedly lying about it. You see people...
And was pardoned by President Trump, we should add.
Yeah. Exactly. You see people in every administration back to Reagan getting charged based on lying when they're targeted in an investigation. So it's really nothing new. It's something that's ongoing.
And President Trump will use this certainly later this week and into next week, because when James Comey testifies on Friday and then that's released, that's going to give him at least a point to pivot to the Clintons and talk about their misdeeds.
We have another caller aboard here. Let's go to you in Sassoon City. Eldon, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm kind of curious, have we ever squared the circle on why the or who was responsible for changing the Republican platform on Crimea at the convention?
Yeah, who was responsible?
I'm going to say the platform committee, but Michael, yeah. That's a good question. No idea.
There was supposedly a good deal of pressure from, shall we say, interests who now maybe even Ken White Mueller is tying in with fighting against the Russian sanctions. At least that's a speculation.
Right. I mean, again, you have the difference between terrible appearances, and that is someone who's going to be president of the United States with a very close relationship with a geopolitical foe versus actually something criminal, which would be participation in illegal things the Russians are doing to hack the election or any sort of quid pro quo type of arrangement. And we haven't seen the evidence of that.
What do you think, Ken, is next for the Mueller investigation as we wrap it up here for this first hour of Forum?
I think you're going to see more related to Michael Cohen's plea. That's a big shoe to drop without more dropping. And I think you're going to see more people charged or implicated in connection to lying about that chain of events, whether lying to the FBI or otherwise lying about it. I also think you're going to see more charges related to the connection to WikiLeaks and whether or not there were communications with them. Jerome Corsi has been talking about how he's about to be charged, and it seems likely that he will be. So I think you're for now going to continue to see what some people are diminishing as process charges about lying to the government. But again, process charges are the heart of most modern federal criminal investigations.
And the political impact of this, David McEwen, they say, you know, nothing affects the Trump base.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the G20, you think about Michael Cohen. This is a White House that's a lot less concerned about optics and how things go more broadly, whether that's looking back at 41 or looking forward for what comes next in 2020. The political impact here, dramatic for Republicans, and whether Republicans can step up and do anything on the Senate side, that'll put the focus moving forward. We've had both the loss of 41 and Senator John McCain, two giants in our politics on that side. Can anyone else on that side step up and perform?
All right, big question. We'll leave it there. David McEwen, thank you so much for joining us. David McEwen, again, is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State University. And Ken White, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken White's an attorney at Brown, White & Osborne, LLP in L.A., and also a former federal prosecutor. We also had Shannon Petty Peace on, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. And we have another Forum Hour ahead, so stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.